morning, which she could not explain. She dismissed them. When she thought of Francisco, she felt the steadying assurance that she would have another month as an advance against the future, as a proof that the world she saw ahead was real, even though it was not the world of those around her. "Hi, Slug. Hi, Frisco." Standing on the hillside, in the first moment of seeing him again, she grasped suddenly the nature of that world which they together held against all others. It was only an instant's pause. She felt her cotton skirt beating in the wind against her knees, felt the sun on her eyelids, and the upward thrust of such an immense relief that she ground her feet into the grass under her sandals, because she thought she would rise weightless through the wind. It was a sudden sense of freedom and safety, because she realized that she knew nothing about the events of his life, had never known and would never need to know. The world of chance, of families, meals, schools, people, of aimless people dragging the load of some unknown guilt, was not theirs, could not change him, could not matter. He and she had never spoken of the things that happened to them, but only of what they thought and of what they would do. She looked at him silently, as if a voice within her were saying, "Not the things that are, but the things we'll make. We are not to be stopped, you and I. Forgive me the fear, if I thought I could lose you to them. Forgive me the doubt, they'll never reach you. I'll never be afraid for you again." He, too, stood looking at her for a moment, and it seemed to her that it was not a look of greeting after an absence, but the look of someone who had thought of her every day of that year. She could not be certain. It was only an instant, so brief that just as she caught it, he was turning to point at the birch tree behind him and saying in the tone of their childhood game, "I wish you'd learn to run faster. I'll always have to wait for you." "Will you wait for me?" she asked gaily. He answered, without smiling, "Always." As they went up the hill to the house, he spoke to Eddie while she walked silently by his side. She felt that there was a new reticence between them, which, strangely, was a new kind of intimacy. She did not question him about the university. Days later, she asked him only whether he liked it. "They're teaching a lot of drivel nowadays," he answered, "but there are a few courses I like." "Have you made any friends there?" "Two." He told her nothing else. Jim was approaching his senior year in a college in New York. His studies had given him a manner of odd, quavering belligerence, as if he had found a new weapon. He addressed Francisco once, without provocation, stopping him in the middle of the lawn to say, in a tone of aggressive self-righteousness, "I think that now that you've reached college age, you ought to learn something about ideals. It's time to forget your selfish greed and give some thought to your social responsibilities, because I think that all those millions you're going to inherit are not for your personal pleasure. They are a trust for the benefit of the underprivileged and the poor, because I think that the person who doesn't realize this is the most depraved type of human being." Francisco answered courteously, "It is not advisable, James, to venture unsolicited opinions. You should spare yourself the embarrassing discovery of their exact value to your listener." Dagny asked him as they walked away, "Are there many men like Jim in the world?" Francisco laughed. "A great many." "Don't you mind it?" "No. I don't have to deal with them." "Why do you ask that?" "Because I think they're dangerous in some way. I don't know how."
"Good God, Dagny. Do you expect me to be afraid of an object like James?"
It was days later when they were alone, walking through the woods on the shore of the river, that she asked,
"Francisco, what's the most depraved type of human being?"
"The man without a purpose." She was looking at the straight shafts of the trees that stood against the great, sudden, shining spread of space beyond. The forest was dim and cool, but the outer branches caught the hot silver sun rays from the water. She wondered why she enjoyed the sight when she had never taken any notice of the country around her, why she was so aware of her enjoyment, of her movements, of her body in the process of walking. She did not want to look at Francisco. She felt that his presence seemed more intensely real when she kept her eyes away from him, almost as if the stressed awareness of herself came from him, like the sunlight from the water.
"You think you're good, don't you?" he asked.
"I always did," she answered defiantly, without turning.
"Well, let me see you prove it. Let me see how far you'll rise with Taggart Transcontinental. No matter how good you are, I'll expect you to wring everything you've got, trying to be still better. And when you've worn yourself out to reach a goal, I'll expect you to start for another."
"Why do you think that I care to prove anything to you?" she asked.
"Want me to answer?"
"No," she whispered, her eyes fixed upon the other shore of the river in the distance. She heard him chuckling, and after a while he said, "Dagny, there's nothing of any importance in life, except how well you do your work. Nothing. Only that. Whatever else you are will come from that. It's the only measure of human value. All the codes of ethics they'll try to ram down your throat are just so much paper money put out by swindlers to fleece people of their virtues. The code of competence is the only system of morality that's on a gold standard. When you grow up, you'll know what I mean."
"I know it now. But, Francisco, why are you and I the only ones who seem to know it?"
"Why should you care about the others?"
"Because I like to understand things, and there's something about people that I can't understand."
"What?"
"Well, I've always been unpopular in school, and it didn't bother me. But now I've discovered the reason. It's an impossible kind of reason. They dislike me, not because I do things badly, but because I do them well. They dislike me because I've always had the best grades in the class. I don't even have to study. I always get A's. Do you suppose I should try to get D's for a change, and become the most popular girl in school?"
Francisco stopped, looked at her, and slapped her face. What she felt was contained in a single instant, while the ground rocked under her feet, in a single blast of emotion within her. She knew that she would have killed any other person who struck her. She felt the violent fury which would have given her the strength for it, and as violent a pleasure that Francisco had done it. She felt pleasure from the dull, hot pain in her cheek and from the taste of blood in the corner of her mouth. She felt pleasure in what she suddenly grasped about him, about herself, and about his motive. She braced her feet to stop the dizziness. She held her head straight and stood facing him in the consciousness of a new power, feeling herself his equal for the first time, looking at him with a mocking smile of triumph.
"Did I hurt you as much as that?" she asked.
He looked astonished. The question and the smile were not those of a child. He answered,
"Yes, if it pleases you."
"It does."
"Don't ever do that again.
Don't crack jokes of that kind."
"Don't be a fool. Whatever made you think that I cared about being popular?"
"When you grow up, you'll understand what sort of unspeakable thing you said."
"I understand it now."
He turned abruptly, took out his handkerchief, and dipped it in the water of the river.
"Come here," he ordered.
She laughed, stepping back.
"Oh, no. I want to keep it as it is. I hope it swells terribly. I like it."
He looked at her for a long moment. He said slowly, very earnestly,
"Dagny, you're wonderful." "I thought that you always thought so," she answered, her voice insolently casual.
When she came home, she told her mother that she had cut her lip by falling against a rock. It was the only lie she ever told. She did not do it to protect Francisco. She did it because she felt, for some reason which she could not define, that the incident was a secret too precious to share. Next summer, when Francisco came, she was 16. She started running down the hill to meet him, but stopped abruptly. He saw it, stopped, and they stood for a moment, looking at each other across the distance of a long green slope. It was he who walked up toward her, walked very slowly, while she stood waiting. When he approached, she smiled innocently
as if unconscious of any contest intended or won. "You might like to know," she said, "that I have a job on the railroad, night operator at Rockdale." He laughed. "All right, Taggart Transcontinental, now it's a race. Let's see who will do greater honor, you to Nat Taggart or I to Sebastian D'Anconia." That winter, she stripped her life down to the bright simplicity of a geometrical drawing. A few straight lines, to and from the engineering college in the city each day, to and from her job at Rockdale Station each night, and the closed circle of her room, a room littered with diagrams of motors, blueprints of steel structures, and railroad timetables. Mrs. Taggart watched her daughter in unhappy bewilderment. She could have forgiven all the omissions but one. Dagny showed no sign of interest in men, no romantic inclination whatever. Mrs. Taggart did not approve of extremes. She had been prepared to contend with an extreme of the opposite kind if necessary. She found herself thinking that this was worse. She felt embarrassed when she had to admit that her daughter, at 17, did not have a single admirer. "Dagny and Francisco D'Anconia," she said, smiling ruefully in answer to the curiosity of her friends. "Oh, no, it's not a romance. It's an international industrial cartel of some kind. That's all they seem to care about." Mrs. Taggart heard James say one evening, in the presence of guests, a peculiar tone of satisfaction in his voice, "Dagny, even though you were named after her, you really look more like Nat Taggart than like that first Dagny Taggart, the famous beauty who was his wife." Mrs. Taggart did not know which offended her most, that James said it, or that Dagny accepted it happily as a compliment. She would never have a chance, thought Mrs. Taggart, to form some conception of her own daughter. Dagny was only a figure hurrying in and out of the apartment, a slim figure in a leather jacket with a raised collar, a short skirt and long showgirl legs. She walked, cutting across a room with a masculine straight-line abruptness, but she had a peculiar grace of motion that was swift, tense, and oddly, challengingly feminine. At times, catching a glimpse of Dagny's face, Mrs. Taggart caught an expression which she could not quite define. It was much more than gaiety. It was the look of such an untouched purity of enjoyment that she found it abnormal, too. No young girl could be so insensitive as to have discovered no sadness in life. Her daughter, she concluded, was incapable of emotion. "Dagny," she asked once, "don't you ever want to have a good time?" Dagny looked at her incredulously and answered, "What do you think I'm having?" The decision to give her daughter a formal debut cost Mrs. Taggart a great deal of anxious thought. She did not know whether she was introducing to New York society Miss Dagny Taggart of the Social Register or the night operator of Rockdale Station. She was inclined to believe it was more truly this last, and she felt certain that Dagny would reject the idea of such an occasion. She was astonished when Dagny accepted it with inexplicable eagerness, for once like a child. She was astonished again when she saw Dagny dressed for the party. It was the first feminine dress she had ever worn, a gown of white chiffon with a huge skirt that floated like a cloud. Mrs. Taggart had expected her to look like a preposterous contrast. Dagny looked like a beauty. She seemed both older and more radiantly innocent than usual. Standing in front of a mirror, she held her head as Nat Taggart's wife would have held it. "Dagny," Mrs. Taggart said gently, reproachfully, "do you see how beautiful you can be when you want to?" "Yes," said Dagny, without any astonishment. The ballroom of the Wayne Falkland Hotel had been decorated under Mrs. Taggart's direction. She had an artist's taste, and the setting of that evening was her masterpiece. "Dagny, there are things I would like you to learn to notice," she said. "Lights, colors, flowers, music. They are not as negligible as you might think." "I've never thought they're negligible," Dagny answered happily. For once Mrs. Taggart felt a bond between them. Dagny was looking at her with a child's grateful trust. They're the things that make life beautiful, said Mrs. Taggart. I want this evening to be very beautiful for you, Dagny. The first ball is the most romantic event of one's life.
To Mrs. Taggart, the greatest surprise was the moment when she saw Dagny standing under the lights, looking at the ballroom.
This was not a child, not a girl, but a woman of such confident, dangerous power that Mrs. Taggart stared at her with shocked admiration. In an age of casual, cynical, indifferent routine, among people who held themselves as if they were not flesh but meat, Dagny's bearing seemed almost indecent, because this was the way a woman would have faced a ballroom centuries ago, when the act of displaying one's half-naked body for the admiration of men was an act of daring, when it had meaning, and but one meaning, acknowledged by all as a high adventure. And this, thought Mrs. Taggart, smiling, was the girl she had believed to be devoid of sexual capacity. She felt an immense relief and a touch of amusement at the thought that a discovery of this kind should make her feel relieved. The relief lasted only for a few hours. At the end of the evening, she saw Dagny in a corner of the ballroom, sitting on a balustrade as if it were a fence rail, her legs dangling under the chiffon skirt as if she were dressed in slacks. She was talking to a couple of helpless young men, her face contemptuously empty. Neither Dagny nor Mrs. Taggart said a word when they rode home together. But hours later, on a sudden impulse, Mrs. Taggart went to her daughter's room. Dagny stood by the window, still wearing the white evening gown. It looked like a cloud supporting a body that now seemed too thin for it, a small body with sagging shoulders. Beyond the window, the clouds were gray in the first light of morning. When Dagny turned, Mrs. Taggart saw only puzzled helplessness in her face. The face was calm, but something about it made Mrs. Taggart wish she had not wished that her daughter should discover sadness.
"Mother, do they think it's exactly in reverse?" she asked.
"What?" asked Mrs. Taggart, bewildered.
"The things you were talking about. The lights and the flowers. Do they expect those things to make them romantic, not the other way around?"
"Darling, what do you mean?"
"There wasn't a person there who enjoyed it," she said, her voice lifeless, "or who thought or felt anything at all. They moved about, and they said the same dull things they say anywhere. I suppose they thought the lights would make it brilliant."
"Darling, you take everything too seriously. One is not supposed to be intellectual at a ball. One is simply supposed to be gay."
"How? By being stupid?"
"I mean, for instance, didn't you enjoy meeting the young men?"
"What men? There wasn't a man there I couldn't squash 10 of."
Days later, sitting at her desk at Rockdale Station, feeling lightheartedly at home, Dagny thought of the party and shrugged in contemptuous reproach at her own disappointment. She looked up. It was spring, and there were leaves on the tree branches in the darkness outside. The air was still and warm. She asked herself what she had expected from that party. She did not know. But she felt it again, here, now, as she sat slouched over a battered desk, looking out into the darkness. A sense of expectation without object, rising through her body slowly, like a warm liquid. She slumped forward across the desk lazily, feeling neither exhaustion nor desire to work. When Francisco came that summer, she told him about the party and about her disappointment. He listened silently, looking at her for the first time with that glance of unmoving mockery which he reserved for others, a glance that seemed to see too much. She felt as if he heard in her words more than she knew she told him. She saw the same glance in his eyes on the evening when she left him too early. They were alone, sitting on the shore of the river. She had another hour before she was due at Rockdale. There were long, thin strips of fire in the sky, and red sparks floating lazily on the water. He had been silent for a long time when she rose abruptly and told him that she had to go. He did not try to stop her. He leaned back, his elbows in the grass, and looked at her without moving. His glance seemed to say that he knew her motive. Hurrying angrily up the slope to the house, she wondered what had made her leave. She did not know. It had been a sudden restlessness that came from a feeling she did not identify till now, a feeling of expectation. Each night she drove the 5 miles from the country house to Rockdale. She came back at dawn, slept a few hours, and got up with the rest of the household. She felt no desire to sleep. Undressing for bed in the first rays of the sun, she felt a tense, joyous, causeless impatience to face the day that was starting. She saw Francisco's mocking glance again across the net of a tennis court. She did not remember the beginning of that game. They had often played tennis together, and he had always won. She did not know at what moment she decided that she would win this time. When she became aware of it, it was no longer a decision or a wish, but a quiet fury rising within her. She did not know why she had to win. She did not know why it seemed so crucially, urgently necessary. She knew only that she had to, and that she would. It seemed easy to play. It was as if her will had vanished and someone's power were playing for her. She watched Francisco's figure, a tall, swift figure, the suntan of his arms stressed by his short white shirt sleeves. She felt an arrogant pleasure in seeing the skill of his movements, because this was the thing which she would beat, so that his every expert gesture became her victory, and the brilliant competence of his body became the triumph of hers. She felt the rising pain of exhaustion, not knowing that it was pain, feeling it only in sudden stabs that made her aware of some part of her body for an instant to be forgotten in the next. Her arm socket, her shoulder blades, her hips with the white shorts sticking to her skin, the muscles of her legs when she leaped to meet the ball but did not remember whether she came down to touch the ground again, her eyelids when the sky went dark red and the ball came at her through the darkness like a whirling white flame, the thin, hot wire that shot from her ankle up her back and went on shooting straight across the air, driving the ball at Francisco's figure. She felt an exultant pleasure, because every stab of pain begun in her body had to end in his, because he was being exhausted as she was. What she did to herself, she was doing it also to him. This was what he felt. This was what she drove him to. It was not her pain that she felt, or her body, but his. In the moments when she saw his face, she saw that he was laughing. He was looking at her as if he understood. He was playing not to win, but to make it harder for her, sending his shots wild to make her run, losing points to see her twist her body in an agonizing backhand, standing still, letting her think he would miss, only to let his arm shoot out casually at the last moment and send the ball back with such force that she knew she would miss it. She felt as if she could not move again, not ever. And it was strange to find herself landing suddenly at the other end of the court, smashing the ball in time, smashing it as if she wished it to burst to pieces, as if she wished it were Francisco's face. Just once more, she thought, even if the next one would crack the bones of her arm. Just once more, even if the air which she forced down in gasps past her tight, swollen throat would be stopped altogether. Then she felt nothing. No pain, no muscles, only the thought that she had to beat him, to see him exhausted, to see him collapse, and then she would be free to die in the next moment. She won. Perhaps it was his laughing that made him lose for once. He walked to the net while she stood still and threw his racket across at her feet as if knowing that this was what she wanted. He walked out of the court and fell down on the grass of the lawn, collapsing, his head on his arm. She approached him slowly. She stood over him, looking down at his body stretched at her feet, looking at his sweat-drenched shirt and the strands of his hair spilled across his arm. He raised his head. His glance moved slowly up the line of her legs, to her shorts, to her blouse, to her eyes. It was a mocking glance that seemed to see straight through her clothes and through her mind, and it seemed to say that he had won. She sat at her desk at Rockdale that night, alone in the old station building, looking at the sky in the window. It was the hour she liked best, when the top panes of the window grew lighter and the rails of the track outside became threads of blurred silver across the lower panes. She turned off her lamp and watched the vast, soundless motion of light over a motionless earth. Things stood still. Not a leaf trembled on the branches, while the sky slowly lost its color and became an expanse that looked like a spread of glowing water. Her telephone was silent at this hour, almost as if movement had stopped everywhere along the system. She heard steps approaching outside, suddenly close to the door. Francisco came in. He had never come here before, but she was not astonished to see him. "What are you doing up at this hour?" she asked. "I didn't feel like sleeping." "How did you get here? I didn't hear your car." "I walked." Moments passed before she realized that she had not asked him why he came, and that she did not want to ask it. He wandered through the room, looking at the clusters of waybills that hung on the walls, at the calendar with a picture of the Taggart comet caught in a proud surge of motion toward the onlooker. He seemed casually at home, as if he felt that the place belonged to them, as they always felt wherever they went together. But he did not seem to want to talk. He asked a few questions about her job, then kept silent. As the light grew outside, movement grew down on the line, and the telephone started ringing in the silence. She turned to her work. He sat in a corner, one leg thrown over the arm of his chair, waiting. She worked swiftly, feeling inordinately clear-headed. She found pleasure in the rapid precision of her hands. She concentrated on the sharp, bright sound of the phone, on the figures of train numbers, car numbers, order numbers. She was conscious of nothing else. But when a thin sheet of paper fluttered down to the floor and she bent to pick it up, she was suddenly as intently conscious of that particular moment, of herself and her own movement. She noticed her gray linen skirt, the rolled sleeve of her gray blouse, and her naked arm reaching down for the paper. She felt her heart stop causelessly in the kind of gasp one feels in moments of anticipation. She picked up the paper and turned back to her desk. It was almost full daylight. A train went past the station without stopping. In the purity of the morning light, the long line of car roofs melted into a silver string, and the train seemed suspended above the ground, not quite touching it, going past through the air. The floor of the station trembled, and glass rattled in the windows. She watched the train's flight with a smile of excitement. She glanced at Francisco. He was looking at her with the same smile. When the day operator arrived, she turned the station over to him, and they walked out into the morning air. The sun had not yet risen, and the air seemed radiant in its stead. She felt no exhaustion. She felt as if she were just getting up. She started toward her car, but Francisco said, "Let's walk home. We'll come for the car later." "All right." She was not astonished, and she did not mind the prospect of walking 5 miles. It seemed natural. Natural to the moment's peculiar reality that was sharply clear, but cut off from everything. Immediate, but disconnected. Like a bright island in a wall of fog. The heightened, unquestioning reality one feels when one is drunk. The road led through the woods. They left the highway for an old trail that went twisting among the trees across miles of untouched country. There were no traces of human existence around them. Old ruts, overgrown with grass, made human presence seem more distant, adding the distance of years to the distance of miles. A haze of twilight remained over the ground, but in the breaks between the tree trunks there were leaves that hung in patches of shining green and seemed to light the forest. The leaves hung still. They walked, alone to move through a motionless world. She noticed suddenly that they had not said a word for a long time. They came to a clearing. It was a small hollow at the bottom of a shaft made of straight rock hillsides. A stream cut across the grass, and tree branches flowed low to the ground like a curtain of green fluid. The sound of the water stressed the silence. The distant cut of open sky made the place seem more hidden. Far above, on the crest of a hill, one tree caught the first rays of sunlight. They stopped and looked at each other. She knew, only when he did it, that she had known he would. He seized her. She felt her lips in his mouth, felt her arms grasping him in violent answer, and knew for the first time how much she had wanted him to do it. She felt a moment's rebellion and a hint of fear. He held her, pressing the length of his body against hers with a tense, purposeful insistence, his hand moving over her breasts as if he were learning a proprietor's intimacy with her body, a shocking intimacy that needed no consent from her, no permission. She tried to pull herself away, but she only leaned back against his arms long enough to see his face and his smile, the smile that told her she had given him permission long ago. She thought that she must escape. Instead, it was she who pulled his head down to find his mouth again. She knew that fear was useless, that he would do what he wished, that the decision was his, that he left nothing possible to her except the thing she wanted most, to submit. She had no conscious realization of his purpose. Her vague knowledge of it was wiped out. She had no power to believe it clearly in this moment, to believe it about herself. She knew only that she was afraid. Yet what she felt was as if she were crying to him, "Don't ask me for it. Oh, don't ask me. Do it." She braced her feet for an instant to resist, but his mouth was pressed to hers and they went down to the ground together, never breaking their lips apart. She lay still, as the motionless, then the quivering object of an act which he did simply, unhesitatingly, as of right, the right of the unendurable pleasure it gave them. He named what it meant to both of them in the first words he spoke afterwards. He said, "We had to learn it from each other." She looked at his long figure stretched on the grass beside her. He wore black slacks and a black shirt. Her eyes stopped on the belt pulled tight across his slender waistline, and she felt the stab of an emotion that was like a gasp of pride, pride in her ownership of his body. She lay on her back, looking up at the sky, feeling no desire to move or think or know that there was any time beyond this moment. When she came home, when she lay in bed, naked because her body had become an unfamiliar possession, too precious for the touch of a nightgown, because it gave her pleasure to feel naked and to feel as if the white sheets of her bed were touched by Francisco's body. When she thought that she would not sleep, because she did not want to rest and lose the most wonderful exhaustion she had ever known, her last thought was of the times when she had wanted to express, but found no way to do it, an instant's knowledge of a feeling greater than happiness, the feeling of one's blessing upon the whole of the earth, the feeling of being in love with the fact that one exists and in this kind of world. She thought that the act she had learned was the way one expressed it. If this was a thought of the gravest importance, she did not know it. Nothing could be grave in a universe from which the concept of pain had been wiped out. She was not there to weigh her conclusion. She was asleep, a faint smile on her face, in a silent, luminous room filled with the light of morning. That summer she met him in the woods, in hidden corners by the river, on the floor of an abandoned shack, in the cellar of the house. These were the only times when she learned to feel a sense of beauty, by looking up at old wooden rafters or at the steel plate of an air-conditioning machine that whirred tensely, rhythmically above their heads. She wore slacks or cotton summer dresses, yet she was never so feminine as when she stood beside him, sagging in his arms, abandoning herself to anything he wished, in open acknowledgment of his power to reduce her to helplessness by the pleasure he had the power to give her. He taught her every manner of sensuality he could invent. "Isn't it wonderful that our bodies can give us so much pleasure?" he said to her once, quite simply. They were happy and radiantly innocent. They were both incapable of the conception that joy is sin. They kept their secret from the knowledge of others, not as a shameful guilt, but as a thing that was immaculately theirs, beyond anyone's right of debate or appraisal. She knew the general doctrine on sex, held by people in one form or another, the doctrine that sex was an ugly weakness of man's lower nature, to be condoned regretfully. She experienced an emotion of chastity that made her shrink, not from the desires of her body, but from any contact with the minds who held this doctrine. That winter, Francisco came to see her in New York at unpredictable intervals. He would fly down from Cleveland without warning twice a week, or he would vanish for months. She would sit on the floor of her room, surrounded by charts and blueprints. She would hear a knock at her door and snap, "I'm busy," then hear a mocking voice ask, "Are you?" and leap to her feet to throw the door open, to find him standing there. They would go to an apartment he had rented in the city, a small apartment in a quiet neighborhood. "Francisco," she asked him once, in sudden astonishment, "I'm your mistress, am I not?" He laughed. "That's what you are." She felt the pride a woman is supposed to experience at being granted the title of wife. In the many months of his absence, she never wondered whether he was true to her or not. She knew he was. She knew, even though she was too young to know the reason, that indiscriminate desire and unselective indulgence were possible only to those who regarded sex and themselves as evil. She knew little about Francisco's life. It was his last year in college. He seldom spoke of it, and she never questioned him. She suspected that he was working too hard, because she saw at times the unnaturally bright look of his face, the look of exhilaration that comes from driving one's energy beyond its limit. She laughed at him once, boasting that she was an old employee of Taggart Transcontinental while he had not started to work for a living. He said, "My father refuses to let me work for Danconia Copper until I graduate." "When did you learn to be obedient?" "I must respect his wishes. He is the owner of Danconia Copper." "He is not, however, the owner of all the copper companies in the world." There was a hint of secret amusement in his smile. She did not learn the story until the next fall, when he had graduated and returned to New York after a visit to his father in Buenos Aires. Then he told her that he had taken two courses of education during the last 4 years, one at the Patrick Henry University, the other in a copper foundry on the outskirts of Cleveland. "I like to learn things for myself," he said. He had started working at the foundry as furnace boy when he was 16, and now, at 20, he owned it. He acquired his first title of property, with the aid of some inaccuracy about his age, on the day when he received his university diploma, and he sent them both to his father. He showed her a photograph of the foundry. It was a small, grimy place, disreputable with age, battered by years of a losing struggle. Above its entrance gate, like a new flag on the mast of a derelict, hung the sign, "Danconia Copper." The public relations man of his father's office in New York had moaned, outraged, "But Don Francisco, you can't do that. What will the public think? That name on a dump of this kind?" "It's my name," Francisco had answered. When he entered his father's office in Buenos Aires, a large room, severe and modern as a laboratory, with photographs of the properties of Danconia Copper as sole ornament on its walls, photographs of the greatest mines, ore docks, and foundries in the world, he saw, in the place of honor, facing his father's desk, a photograph of the Cleveland foundry with the new sign above its gate. His father's eyes moved from the photograph to Francisco's face as he stood in front of the desk. "Isn't it a little too soon?" his father asked. "I couldn't have stood 4 years of nothing but lectures." "Where did you get the money for your first payment on that property?" "By playing the New York stock market." "What? Who taught you to do that?" "It is not difficult to judge which industrial ventures will succeed and which won't." "Where did you get the money to play with?" "From the allowance you sent me, sir, and from my wages." "When did you have time to watch the stock market?" "While I was writing a thesis on the influence upon subsequent metaphysical systems
of Aristotle's theory of the immovable mover. Francisco's stay in New York was brief that fall. His father was sending him to Montana as assistant superintendent of a Danconia mine. "Oh, well," he said to Dagny, smiling, "my father does not think it advisable to let me rise too fast. I would not ask him to take me on faith. If he wants a factual demonstration, I shall comply." In the spring, Francisco came back as head of the New York office of Danconia Copper. She did not see him often in the next 2 years. She never knew where he was, in what city or on what continent, the day after she had seen him. He always came to her unexpectedly, and she liked it, because it made him a continuous presence in her life, like the ray of a hidden light that could hit her at any moment. Whenever she saw him in his office, she thought of his hands as she had seen them on the wheel of a motorboat. He drove his business with the same smooth, dangerous, confidently mastered speed. But one small incident remained in her mind as a shock. It did not fit him. She saw him standing at the window of his office one evening, looking at the brown winter twilight of the city. He did not move for a long time. His face was hard and tight. It had the look of an emotion she had never believed possible to him, of bitter, helpless anger. He said, "There's something wrong in the world. There's always been. Something no one has ever named or explained." He would not tell her what it was. When she saw him again, no trace of that incident remained in his manner. It was spring, and they stood together on the roof terrace of a restaurant, the light silk of her evening gown blowing in the wind against his tall figure in formal black clothes. They looked at the city. In the dining room behind them, the sounds of the music were a concert etude by Richard Halley. Halley's name was not known to many, but they had discovered it, and they loved his music. Francisco said, "We don't have to look for skyscrapers in the distance, do we? We've reached them." She smiled and said, "I think we're going past them. I'm almost afraid. We're on a speeding elevator of some kind." "Sure. Afraid of what? Let it speed. Why should there be a limit?" He was 23 when his father died, and he went to Buenos Aires to take over the Danconia estate, now his. She did not see him for 3 years. He wrote to her at first, at random intervals. He wrote about Danconia Copper, about the world market, about issues affecting the interests of Taggart Transcontinental. His letters were brief, written by hand, usually at night. She was not unhappy in his absence. She, too, was making her first steps toward the control of a future kingdom. Among the leaders of industry, her father's friends, she heard it said that one had better watch the young Danconia heir. If that copper company had been great before, it would sweep the world now under what his management promised to become. She smiled, without astonishment. There were moments when she felt a sudden, violent longing for him, but it was only impatience, not pain. She dismissed it, in the confident knowledge that they were both working toward a future that would bring them everything they wanted, including each other. Then his letters stopped. She was 24 on that day of spring when the telephone rang on her desk in an office of the Taggart building. "Dagny," said a voice she recognized at once, "I'm at the Wayne Falkland. Come to have dinner with me tonight. At 7. He said it without greeting, as if they had parted the day before. Because it took her a moment to regain the art of breathing, she realized for the first time how much that voice meant to her. "All right, Francisco," she answered. They needed to say nothing else. She thought, replacing the receiver, that his return was natural, and as she had always expected it to happen, except that she had not expected her sudden need to pronounce his name or the stab of happiness she felt while pronouncing it. When she entered his hotel room that evening, she stopped short. He stood in the middle of the room looking at her, and she saw a smile that came slowly, involuntarily, as if he had lost the ability to smile and were astonished that he should regain it. He looked at her incredulously,
not quite believing what she was or what he felt. His glance was like a plea, like the cry for help of a man who could never cry. At her entrance, he had started their old salute. He had started to say, "Hi," but he did not finish it. Instead, after a moment, he said, "You're beautiful, Dagny." He said it as if it hurt him. "Francisco, I..." He shook his head, not to let her pronounce the words they had never said to each other, even though they knew that both had said and heard them in that moment. He approached. He took her in his arms. He kissed her mouth and held her for a long time. When she looked up at his face, he was smiling down at her confidently, derisively. It was a smile that told her he was in control of himself, of her, of everything, and ordered her to forget what she had seen in that first moment. "Hi, slug," he said, feeling certain of nothing except that she must not ask questions. She smiled and said, "Hi, Frisco." She could have understood any change, but not the things she saw. There was no sparkle of life in his face, no hint of amusement. The face had become implacable. The plea of his first smile had not been a plea of weakness. He had acquired an air of determination that seemed merciless. He acted like a man who stood straight under the weight of an unendurable burden. She saw what she could not have believed possible, that there were lines of bitterness in his face, and that he looked tortured. "Dagny, don't be astonished by anything I do," he said, "or by anything I may ever do in the future." That was the only explanation he granted her, then proceeded to act as if there were nothing to explain. She could feel no more than a faint anxiety. It was impossible to feel fear for his fate or in his presence. When he laughed, she thought they were back in the woods by the Hudson. He had not changed, and never would. The dinner was served in his room. She found it amusing to face him across a table laid out with the icy formality pertaining to excessive cost in a hotel room designed as a European palace. The Wayne Falkland was the most distinguished hotel left on any continent. Its style of indolent luxury, of velvet drapes, sculptured panels, and candlelight seemed a deliberate contrast to its function. No one could afford its hospitality except men who came to New York on business, to settle transactions involving the world. She noticed that the manner of the waiters who served their dinner suggested a special deference to this particular guest of the hotel, and that Francisco did not notice it. He was indifferently at home. He had long since become accustomed to the fact that he was Señor D'Anconia of D'Anconia Copper. But she thought it strange that he did not speak about his work. She had expected it to be his only interest, the first thing he would share with her. He did not mention it. He led her to talk instead about her job, her progress, and what she felt for Taggart Transcontinental. She spoke of it as she had always spoken to him, in the knowledge that he was the only one who could understand her passionate devotion. He made no comment, but he listened intently. A waiter had turned on the radio for dinner music. They had paid no attention to it. But suddenly a crash of sound jarred the room, almost as if a subterranean blast had struck the walls and made them tremble. The shock came not from the loudness, but from the quality of the sounds. It was Halley's new concerto, recently written, the 4th. They sat in silence, listening to the statement of rebellion, the anthem of the triumph of the great victims who would refuse to accept pain. Francisco listened, looking out at the city. Without transition or warning, he asked, his voice oddly unstressed, "Dagny, what would you say if I asked you to leave Taggart Transcontinental and let it go to hell, as it will when your brother takes over?" "What would I say if you asked me to consider the idea of committing suicide?" she answered angrily. He remained silent. "Why did you say that?" she snapped. "I didn't think you'd joke about it. It's not like you." There was no touch of humor in his face. He answered quietly, gravely, "No, of course, I shouldn't." She brought herself to question him about his work. He answered the questions. He volunteered nothing. She repeated to him the comments of the industrialists about the brilliant prospects of Danconia Copper under his management. "That's true," he said, his voice lifeless. In sudden anxiety, not knowing what prompted her, she asked, "Francisco, why did you come to New York?" He answered slowly, "To see a friend who called for me." "Business?" Looking past her, as if answering a thought of his own, a faint smile of bitter amusement on his face, but his voice strangely soft and sad, he answered, "Yes." It was long past midnight when she awakened in bed by his side. No sounds came from the city below. The stillness of the room made life seem suspended for a while. Relaxed in happiness and in complete exhaustion, she turned lazily to glance at him. He lay on his back, half propped by a pillow. She saw his profile against the foggy glow of the night sky in the window. He was awake. His eyes were open. He held his mouth closed like a man lying in resignation in unbearable pain, bearing it, making no attempt to hide it. She was too frightened to move. He felt her glance and turned to her. He shuddered suddenly. He threw off the blanket. He looked at her naked body. Then he fell forward and buried his face between her breasts. He held her shoulders, hanging on to her convulsively. She heard the words muffled, his mouth pressed to her skin. "I can't give it up. I can't." "What?" she whispered.
"You."
"Why should?"
"And everything."
"Why should you give it up?"
"Dagny,
help me to remain, to refuse, even though he's right." She asked evenly, "To refuse what, Francisco?" He did not answer, only pressed his face harder against her. She lay very still, conscious of nothing but a supreme need of caution. His head on her breast, her hand caressing his hair gently, steadily, she lay looking up at the ceiling of the room, at the sculptured garlands faintly visible in the darkness, and she waited, numb with terror. He moaned,
"It's right, but it's so hard to do.
Oh God, it's so hard." After a while he raised his head. He sat up. He had stopped trembling. "What is it, Francisco?"
"I can't tell you."
His voice was simple, open, without attempt to disguise suffering, but it was a voice that obeyed him now.
"You're not ready to hear it."
"I want to help you."
"You can't."
"You said to help you refuse."
"I can't refuse."
"Then let me share it with you." He shook his head. He sat looking down at her as if weighing a question. Then he shook his head again in answer to himself.
"If I'm not sure I can stand it," he said,
and the strange new note in his voice was tenderness, "how could you?" She said slowly, with effort, trying to keep herself from screaming, "Francisco, I have to know.
Will you forgive me?
I know you're frightened and it's cruel, but will you do this for me? Will you let it go, just let it go, and don't ask me anything?
That's all you can do for me. Will you?"
"Yes, Francisco."
"Don't be afraid for me.
It was just this once. It won't happen to me again. It will become much easier. Later. If I could..."
"No. Go to sleep, dearest."
It was the first time he had ever used that word. In the morning he faced her openly, not avoiding her anxious glance, but saying nothing about it. She saw both serenity and suffering in the calm of his face, an expression like a smile of pain, though he was not smiling. Strangely, it made him look younger. He did not look like a man bearing torture now, but like a man who sees that which makes the torture worth bearing. She did not question him. Before leaving, she asked only, "When will I see you again?" He answered, "I don't know."
Don't wait for me, Dagny. Next time we meet, you will not want to see me. I have a reason for the things I'll do, but I can't tell you the reason, and you will be right to damn me. I am not committing the contemptible act of asking you to take me on faith. You have to live by your own knowledge and judgment. You will damn me. You will be hurt. Try not to let it hurt you too much. Remember that I told you this, and that it was all I could tell you. She heard nothing from him or about him for a year. When she began to hear gossip and to read newspaper stories, she did not believe at first that they referred to Francisco D'Anconia. After a while, she had to believe it. She read the story of the party he gave on his yacht in the harbor of Valparaiso. The guests wore bathing suits, and an artificial rain of champagne and flower petals kept falling upon the decks throughout the night. She read the story of the party he gave at an Algerian desert resort. He built a pavilion of thin sheets of ice and presented every woman guest with an ermine wrap as a gift to be worn for the occasion, on condition that they remove their wraps, then their evening gowns, then all the rest, in tempo with the melting of the walls. She read the accounts of the business ventures he undertook at lengthy intervals. The ventures were spectacularly successful and ruined his competitors, but he indulged in them as in an occasional sport, staging a sudden raid, then vanishing from the industrial scene for a year or two, leaving D'Anconia Copper to the management of his employees. She read the interview where he said, "Why should I wish to make money? I have enough to permit 3 generations of descendants to have as good a time as I'm having." She saw him once at a reception given by an ambassador in New York. He bowed to her courteously, he smiled, and he looked at her with a glance in which no past existed. She drew him aside. She said only, "Francisco, why?" "Why? What?" he asked. She turned away. "I warned you," he said. She did not try to see him again. She survived it. She was able to survive it because she did not believe in suffering. She faced with astonished indignation the ugly fact of feeling pain, and refused to let it matter. Suffering was a senseless accident. It was not part of life as she saw it. She would not allow pain to become important. She had no name for the kind of resistance she offered, for the emotion from which the resistance came. But the words that stood as its equivalent in her mind were, "It does not count. It is not to be taken seriously." She knew these were the words, even in the moments when there was nothing left within her but screaming, and she wished she could lose the faculty of consciousness so that it would not tell her that what could not be true was true. Not to be taken seriously. An immovable certainty within her kept repeating, "Pain and ugliness are never to be taken seriously." She fought it. She recovered. Years helped her to reach the day when she could face her memories indifferently, then the day when she felt no necessity to face them. It was finished, and of no concern to her any longer. There had been no other men in her life. She did not know whether this had made her unhappy. She had had no time to know. She found the clean, brilliant sense of life as she wanted it, in her work. Once, Francisco had given her the same sense, a feeling that belonged with her work and in her world. The men she had met since were like the men she met at her first ball. She had won the battle against her memories, but one form of torture remained, untouched by the years, the torture of the word, "Why?" Whatever the tragedy he met, why had Francisco taken the ugliest way of escape, as ignoble as the way of some cheap alcoholic? The boy she had known could not have become a useless coward. An incomparable mind could not turn its ingenuity to the invention of melting ballrooms. Yet he had and did, and there was no explanation to make it conceivable and to let her forget him in peace. She could not doubt the fact of what he had been. She could not doubt the fact of what he had become. Yet one made the other impossible. At times she almost doubted her own rationality or the existence of any rationality anywhere. But this was a doubt which she did not permit to anyone. Yet there was no explanation, no reason, no clue to any conceivable reason. And in all the days of 10 years, she had found no hint of an answer. No, she thought, as she walked through the gray twilight, past the windows of abandoned shops, to the Wayne Falkland Hotel. No, there could be no answer. She would not seek it. It did not matter now. The remnant of violence, the emotion rising as a thin trembling within her, was not for the man she was going to see. It was a cry of protest against a sacrilege, against the destruction of what had been greatness. In a break between buildings, she saw the towers of the Wayne Falkland. She felt a slight jolt in her lungs and legs that stopped her for an instant. Then she walked on evenly. By the time she walked through the marble lobby to the elevator, then down the wide, velvet-carpeted, soundless corridors of the Wayne Falkland, she felt nothing but a cold anger that grew colder with every step. She was certain of the anger when she knocked at his door. She heard his voice answering, "Come in." She jerked the door open and entered. Francisco Domingo Carlos Andrés Sebastián D'Anconia sat on the floor, playing marbles. Nobody ever wondered whether Francisco D'Anconia was good-looking or not. It seemed irrelevant. When he entered a room, it was impossible to look at anyone else. His tall, slender figure had an air of distinction, too authentic to be modern, and he moved as if he had a cape floating behind him in the wind. People explained him by saying that he had the vitality of a healthy animal, but they knew dimly that that was not correct. He had the vitality of a healthy human being, a thing so rare that no one could identify it. He had the power of certainty. Nobody described his appearance as Latin, yet the word applied to him, not in its present, but in its original sense, not pertaining to Spain, but to ancient Rome. His body seemed designed as an exercise in consistency of style, a style made of gauntness, of tight flesh, long legs, and swift movements. His features had the fine precision of sculpture. His hair was black and straight, swept back. The suntan of his skin intensified the startling color of his eyes. They were a pure, clear blue. His face was open, its rapid changes of expression reflecting whatever he felt, as if he had nothing to hide. The blue eyes were still and changeless, never giving a hint of what he thought. He sat on the floor of his drawing room, dressed in sleeping pajamas of thin black silk. The marbles spread on the carpet around him were made of the semi-precious stones of his native country, carnelian and rock crystal. He did not rise when Dagny entered. He sat looking up at her, and a crystal marble fell like a teardrop out of his hand. He smiled, the unchanged, insolent, brilliant smile of his childhood. "Hi, slug," she heard herself answering, irresistibly, helplessly, happily. "Hi, Frisco." She was looking at his face. It was the face she had known. It bore no mark of the kind of life he had led, nor of what she had seen on their last night together. There was no sign of tragedy, no bitterness, no tension. Only the radiant mockery, matured and stressed, the look of dangerously unpredictable amusement, and the great, guiltless serenity of spirit. But this, she thought, was impossible. This was more shocking than all the rest. His eyes were studying her, the battered coat thrown open, half slipping off her shoulders, and the slender body in a gray suit that looked like an office uniform. "If you came here dressed like this in order not to let me notice how lovely you are," he said, "you miscalculated. You're lovely. I wish I could tell you what a relief it is to see a face that's intelligent, though a woman's. But you don't want to hear it. That's not what you came here for."
The words were improper in so many ways, yet were said so lightly that they brought her back to reality, to anger, and to the purpose of her visit. She remained standing, looking down at him, her face blank, refusing him any recognition of the personal, even of its power to offend her. She said, "I came here to ask you a question."
"Go ahead."
"When you told those reporters that you came to New York to witness the farce, which farce did you mean?"
He laughed aloud, like a man who seldom finds a chance to enjoy the unexpected.
"That's what I like about you, Dagny. There are 7 million people in the city of New York at present. Out of 7 million people, you are the only one to whom it could have occurred that I wasn't talking about the Vail divorce scandal."
"What were you talking about?"
"What alternative occurred to you?"
"The San Sebastian disaster."
"That's much more amusing than the Vail divorce scandal, isn't it?" She said in the solemn, merciless tone of a prosecutor,
"You did it consciously, cold-bloodedly, and with full intention.
Don't you think it would be better if you took your coat off and sat down?" She knew she had made a mistake by betraying too much intensity. She turned coldly, removed her coat, and threw it aside. He did not rise to help her. She sat down in an armchair. He remained on the floor at some distance, but it seemed as if he were sitting at her feet.
"What was it I did with full intention?" he asked.
"The entire San Sebastian swindle."
"What was my full intention?"
"That is what I want to know."
He chuckled, as if she had asked him to explain in conversation a complex science requiring a lifetime of study.
"You knew that the San Sebastian mines were worthless," she said. "You knew it before you began the whole wretched business."
"Then why did I begin it?"
"Don't start telling me that you gained nothing. I know it. I know you lost $15 million of your own money. Yet it was done on purpose."
"Can you think of a motive that would prompt me to do it?"
"No. It's inconceivable."
"Is it? You assume that I have a great mind, a great knowledge, and a great productive ability, so that anything I undertake must necessarily be successful. And then you claim that I had no desire to put out my best effort for the people's state of Mexico. Inconceivable, isn't it?"
"You knew before you bought that property that Mexico was in the hands of a looter's government. You didn't have to start a mining project for them."
"No, I didn't have to."
"You didn't give a damn about that Mexican government one way or another because..."
"You're wrong about that."
"Because you knew they'd seize those mines sooner or later. What you were after is your American stockholders."
"That's true." He was looking straight at her. He was not smiling. His face was earnest. He added, "That's part of the truth."
"What's the rest?"
"It was not all I was after."
"What else?"
"That's for you to figure out."
"I came here because I wanted you to know that I am beginning to understand your purpose."
He smiled. "If you did, you wouldn't have come here."
"That's true. I don't understand, and probably never shall. I am merely beginning to see part of it."
"Which part?"
"You had exhausted every other form of depravity and sought a new thrill by swindling people like Jim and his friends in order to watch them squirm. I don't know what sort of corruption could make anyone enjoy that, but that's what you came to New York to see at the right time."
"They certainly provided a spectacle of squirming on the grand scale. Your brother James in particular."
"They're rotten fools, but in this case their only crime was that they trusted you. They trusted your name and your honor."
Again she saw the look of earnestness, and again knew with certainty that it was genuine when he said, "Yes, they did. I know it."
"And do you find it amusing?"
No, I don't find it amusing at all. He had continued playing with his marbles, absently, indifferently, taking a shot once in a while. She noticed suddenly the faultless accuracy of his aim, the skill of his hands. He merely flicked his wrist and sent a drop of stone shooting across the carpet to click sharply against another drop. She thought of his childhood and of the predictions that anything he did would be done superlatively. No, he said, I don't find it amusing. Your brother James and his friends knew nothing about the copper mining industry. They knew nothing about making money. They did not think it necessary to learn. They considered knowledge superfluous and judgment inessential. They observed that there I was in the world and that I made it my honor to know. They thought they could trust my honor. One does not betray a trust of this kind, does one? Then you did betray it intentionally. That's for you to decide. It was you who spoke about their trust and my honor. I don't think in such terms any longer. He shrugged, adding, I don't give a damn about your brother James and his friends. Their theory was not new. It has worked for centuries. But it wasn't foolproof. There is just one point that they overlooked. They thought it was safe to ride on my brain, because they assumed that the goal of my journey was wealth. All their calculations rested on the premise that I wanted to make money. What if I didn't? If you didn't, what did you want? They never asked me that. Not to inquire about my aims, motives, or desires is an essential part of their theory. If you didn't want to make money, what possible motive could you have had? Any number of them. For instance, to spend it. To spend money on a certain total failure? How was I to know that those mines were a certain total failure? How could you help knowing it? Quite simply, by giving it no thought. You started that project without giving it any thought. No, not exactly. But suppose I slipped up. I'm only human. I made a mistake. I failed. I made a bad job of it. He flicked his wrist. A crystal marble shot sparkling across the floor and cracked violently against a brown one at the other end of the room. I don't believe it, she said. No. But haven't I the right to be what is now accepted as human? Should I pay for everybody's mistakes and never be permitted one of my own? That's not like you. No. He stretched himself full length on the carpet, lazily, relaxing. Did you intend me to notice that if you think I did it on purpose, then you still give me credit for having a purpose? You're still unable to accept me as a bum. She closed her eyes. She heard him laughing. It was the gayest sound in the world. She opened her eyes hastily, but there was no hint of cruelty in his face, only pure laughter. My motive, Dagny? You don't think that it's the simplest one of all? The spur of the moment? No, she thought. No, that's not true. Not if he laughed like that. Not if he looked as he did. The capacity for unclouded enjoyment, she thought, does not belong to irresponsible fools. An inviolate peace of spirit is not the achievement of a drifter. To be able to laugh like that is the end result of the most profound, most solemn thinking. Almost dispassionately, looking at his figure stretched on the carpet at her feet, she observed what memory it brought back to her. The black pajamas stressed the long lines of his body. The open collar showed a smooth, young, sunburned skin. And she thought of the figure in black slacks and shirt stretched beside her on the grass at sunrise. She had felt pride then, the pride of knowing that she owned his body. She still felt it. She remembered suddenly, specifically, the excessive acts of their intimacy,
The memory should have been offensive to her now, but wasn't. It was still pride, without regret or hope, an emotion that had no power to reach her, and that she had no power to destroy. Unaccountably, by an association of feeling that astonished her, she remembered what had conveyed to her recently the same sense of consummate joy as his.
"Francisco," she heard herself saying softly, "we both loved the music of Richard Halley."
"I still love it."
"Have you ever met him?"
"Yes." "Why?"
"Do you happen to know whether he has written a fifth concerto?"
He remained perfectly still. She had thought him impervious to shock. He wasn't. But she could not attempt to guess why, of all the things she had said, this should be the first to reach him. It was only an instant. Then he asked evenly, "What makes you think he has?"
"Well, has he?"
"You know that there are only 4 Halley concertos."
"Yes."
"But I wondered whether he had written another one."
"He has stopped writing."
"I know." "Then what made you ask that?"
"Just an idle thought. What is he doing now? Where is he?"
"I don't know. I haven't seen him for a long time. What made you think that there was a fifth concerto?"
"I didn't say there was. I merely wondered about it."
"Why did you think of Richard Halley just now?"
"Because," she felt her control cracking a little, "because my mind can't make the leap from Richard Halley's music to Mrs. Gilbert Vale."
He laughed, relieved. "Oh, that. Incidentally, if you've been following my publicity, have you noticed a funny little discrepancy in the story of Mrs. Gilbert Vale?"
"I don't read the stuff."
"You should. She gave such a beautiful description of last New Year's Eve, which we spent together in my villa in the Andes. The moonlight on the mountain peaks, and the blood-red flowers hanging on vines in the open windows. See anything wrong in the picture?" She said quietly,
"It's I who should ask you that, and I'm not going to."
"Oh, I see nothing wrong. Except that last New Year's Eve, I was in El Paso, Texas, presiding at the opening of the San Sebastian line of Taggart Transcontinental, as you should remember, even if you didn't choose to be present on the occasion. I had my picture taken with my arms around your brother James and the Senor Orin Boyle." She gasped, remembering that this was true, remembering also that she had seen Mrs. Vale's story in the newspapers.
"Francisco, what does that mean?"
He chuckled. "Draw your own conclusions." "Dagny," his face was serious, "why did you think of Halley writing a fifth concerto? Why not a new symphony or opera? Why specifically a concerto?
Why does that disturb you?"
"It doesn't." He added softly, "I still love his music, Dagny." Then he spoke lightly again. "But it belonged to another age. Our age provides a different kind of entertainment." He rolled over on his back and lay with his hands crossed under his head, looking up as if he were watching the scenes of a movie farce unrolling on the ceiling. "Dagny, didn't you enjoy the spectacle of the behavior of the people's state of Mexico in regard to the San Sebastian mines? Did you read their government's speeches and the editorials in their newspapers? They're saying that I am an unscrupulous cheat who has defrauded them. They expected to have a successful mining concern to seize. I had no right to disappoint them like that. Did you read about the scabby little bureaucrat who wanted them to sue me?" He laughed, lying flat on his back. His arms were thrown wide on the carpet, forming a cross with his body. He seemed disarmed, relaxed, and young. "It was worth whatever it's cost me. I could afford the price of that show. If I had staged it intentionally, I would have beaten the record of the Emperor Nero. What's burning a city?
compared to tearing the lid off hell and letting men see it. He raised himself, picked up a few marbles, and sat shaking them absently in his hand. They clicked with the soft, clear sound of good stone. She realized suddenly that playing with those marbles was not a deliberate affectation on his part. It was restlessness. He could not remain inactive for long. "The government of the People's State of Mexico has issued a proclamation," he said, "asking the people to be patient and put up with hardships just a little longer. It seems that the copper fortune of the San Sebastian mines was part of the plans of the Central Planning Council. It was to raise everybody's standard of living and provide a roast of pork every Sunday for every man.